vulnerability, authenticity are core values and important to the team and structure and culture I want to create and be around. I think when I don't live authentically, I feel really crummy. And I think a lot of training was like that for me. My book, in some ways, is an exploration of how much of myself I sort of lost in medical training because I was just trying to do what I had to do to survive this sort of hierarchical, feelingless system as an empath who hates hierarchy.
Hi, guys. Laura Coons, your host of Prevention Pioneers. Welcome back. Today on our show, we are thrilled to have Dr. Jesse Gold. And Jesse is a best-selling author. She is also the chief wellness officer of all 5 campuses of the University of Tennessee. Have to mention that. Big job. And actually, I want to start with that. How did that come about? How did you, because that was a new role, right? I mean, they'd never had this position. Do other universities have this position? How did that happen?
It's a really good question. I ask myself that often. I mean, I think for me, you know, basically the current president of UT, President Randy Boyd, is really into this concept of one UT, meaning like all 5 schools have their own identities, but we share things, we support each other, we share best practices, we are more like integrated than we are separate. And in the context of that, sort of mental health and wellness rose to the top of the conversation, which is like, how do we center that as a value across the system, even if every school has its own culture and size and context and the way we're having these conversations? Like, how do we center it as a value? How do we make sure all of the schools have some of the same stuff, some of the same policies, some of the same access to care? And it was born out of that conversation, really, of like how to make it more uniform and make it something more of a value across the state and make it something that we're all really focused on and prioritizing. And the chancellor at the campus I live at is a psychiatrist, which is cool. Yeah. And he was also very like excited about this idea as like the chief wellness officer role has really kind of grown from the healthcare space in a lot of ways. And so there are like hospital systems that have it and some med schools that have it. And we've been seeing that kind of evolve over time, but there isn't a lot in higher ed. And so he saw that kind of happening in parallel and was like, well, there's this job that seems to be kind of like a thing that's coming out in healthcare, but maybe not as much in higher ed yet, but it's something to be looking at. And what do you think about having someone who can have a bird's eye view of these things? And, oh, I know this person who's kind of looking for a job. And that's kind of where that came from. And then I had to kind of like meet with a lot of people and convince them that I was the right person for the job. But you know,
I was going to say, like, it can't be an easy job to get. There are so many. So when that happened, were you in private practice? So I also want to mention to you all, Dr. Gold is a psychiatrist. So bridge that gap.
Yeah. So I went to residency at Stanford. And after residency, I took a job at Washington University in St. Louis. And I was the psychiatrist on the college campus there right out of residency.
Okay.
And so I did clinic in the campus and then did some sort of administrative stuff intermittently. But really then the pandemic happened.
Yeah.
And in the context of the pandemic, I was one of the few people on campus who had had experience doing healthcare worker mental health research and advocacy and sort of asked a question that ended up me being in charge of something, which was I said, like, you know, I'm watching the coast and I'm just curious, like, what we're doing for the mental health of the healthcare workers. And my chairman was like, oh, that's a really good idea.
Just
like, what are we doing, Jesse? And so I basically got tasked with a couple other people kind of like making a plan for how our department was going to support the well-being of the healthcare workers. And, you know, like initially sort of in heightened crisis, not necessarily in a prolonged sense. And then that kind of became much longer. You know, I got furloughed in that context from the undergrad because all the undergrads were not coming back on campus, and I was full-time faculty. So they were like, hey, Jesse, what are you going to do with your clinic because you can't see undergrads right now? And I was like, oh, I'll open a clinic and see healthcare workers and dependents. And so I, at the same time, like sort of aligned my clinical practice with what I was doing administratively. And so I was doing faculty and staff wellness, outreach, prevention, setting up the clinic for the healthcare workers and their dependents. So I was the psychiatrist, and then we started to hire therapists and sort of have an internal EAP in the same way that we also had an external one.
Wow.
And in that setting, like, ended up doing a lot of this sort of like systems approach to thinking about things. I guess I was in the right place at the right time to be doing that in the height of a pandemic or something. But, you know, that sort of led me to then, when I was looking for other jobs, to kind of still do well-being, but also get to go back to doing more college stuff. Because I really liked, like, if you would ask me, in residency, for sure, I'd have been like, I'm going to work on a college campus. And like, oh, that's okay. What I'm going to
do. So. So it was like, yeah. Okay. So that was like in your heart, you had a special. Yeah. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Special like interest in that from my own like lived experiences and sort of really finding that population fun. And then like, you know, I had the similar feeling about healthcare workers, and now I have the ability to kind of blend it because we have 5 campuses and one of them's a health science center. So it's not like I'm just doing undergrads or something. It also is the healthcare like students, which is cool.
Look at what you manifested for yourself. That is, that just gave me chills though, because that is, you know, it's like you come across certain people, and I believe we're all kind of here on a mission, right? Like, I do believe in life purpose, and that's such an important part of self-awareness and building self-awareness and learning about yourself is understanding what your purpose is. And when you come across people that are truly living their purpose, and it's interesting because with purpose, at least in my experience and experiences I've witnessed, also comes a lot of trials and tribulations and kind of your own journey of personal growth to stay on that purpose and to continue to fulfill that mission, because a lot of times it's a trail that's being blazed. It's not there. It's not already there. And in following your work and kind of immersing myself in the world of Jesse, we'll switch to Jesse now versus Dr. Gold, like the person, you know, I do see that you've really, you're so committed to these messages. You're so committed to these populations, you know, that were underserved in these ways prior. And yeah, I just think that's so special. So anyway,
thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because like, I don't think I would have, I mean, it's a job that didn't exist. So I don't know that I would have ever told you like in 10 years, I'll do this. And even when I kind of think now, it's like one of my bosses will be like, what's your like long-term goal? And I'm like, I don't like to think about that because I don't know, like these things kind of come as they come and they develop. And I'd rather like not have a narrow-minded like opinion of like, oh, I have to do this or that's where I want to be. And if I did that, I wouldn't have really stepped up in the pandemic either, because I would have been like, I want to do college mental health. Like, I only do research in healthcare worker stuff. I'm not seeing them as patients. Like, no. But it was like no one else really knew that where I was. And it was I was in the right place to help with that. Like, you know, in other systems where they already had a lot of people who were doing that, I wouldn't have really had that opportunity. And so, you know, I think I've been always really like open to seeing what comes out of just being like interested in something and asking questions. And I think that curiosity has been helpful and not like limiting. And like, in so many ways, I feel like work is really important to me and obviously is central to like where I get meaning and value and helping people and all of that stuff. But I think you have to also say like, okay, well, why is that? And what about that do you like? And is there other ways you could get that outside of work too? And all of that. So,
well, yeah, like you are just yourself. You show up as yourself and work and in the other aspects of your life. And that is, you know, in the whole conversation about burnout, which I want to touch on in a little bit too, because I know that you're an expert in that. You're a subject matter expert in burnout. Or, you know, for those listening, Jessie is she's a known speaker nationally and internationally on burnout and burnout prevention, you know, which is one of the reasons that we asked you on the show. But I also see that you, you know, I think being yourself and building the skill set to be able to do that in all settings and integrating that is super important to burnout prevention. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like vulnerability, authenticity are like core values and important to sort of the team and structure and culture I want to create and be around. You know, I think when I don't live authentically, I feel really crummy. And I think a lot of training was like that for me. I think my book in some ways is an exploration of how much of myself I sort of lost in medical training because yeah. I was just trying to do what I had to do to survive this sort of like hierarchical, like feelingless system as an empath who hates hierarchy. Wow. And so like, you know, I think some of that is subtle and you don't realize that it happens until you like recognize that some stuff is different. And then, you know, when you try to go back to kind of living that way, it's much better for me and has been better for me. It doesn't mean everybody likes me. You know, it doesn't mean it doesn't cause like any issues in a workplace that's like, you know, more traditional like healthcare is, or that, you know, they wouldn't want me to be like more formal or like different. But I don't know, like, I don't really care anymore. Like, I think I did care. And that's like sort of, you know, something that I recognize. But as I've gotten older and like, you know, people have liked me for me and it's helped with my own success, I feel more able to say like, well, it's stupid to do what people tell you to do. Like if you're like successful for who you are, like just do that. But, you know, it's easier said than done. Like I would have a hard time telling a student that like the answer is like just ignore people and be yourself entirely like it's great. Like I wish I could have done that, but it would have been really hard to get through training as like, you know, a bit obstinate and like thinking hierarchy stupid. And, you know, it was hard and I had to shut down a lot of that. And so I think it's like definitely easier as a like grown up or, you know, like it's
I totally
easier.
Know.
Like it's
I relate. I do personally. I relate so much to everything you're saying. I really do. Cause it's a process to learn how and when to use that muscle. You know, first, it's like realizing that you have the muscle to be yourself and to make independent decisions and to trust your gut and then to use your voice to speak out on that. And then it's a whole other skill set to know when to do that and when to not. Does it need to be said right now? Does it need to be said by me? You know, all of those things. And then also, to your point, if you're working in a system. And I think a lot of people struggle with that, which is why we see this mass exodus from the workforce, because they don't buy in to these traditional structure, the structure of a hierarchy. And they're just kind of like, no. And then we're also seeing that in healthcare. People are kind of like not following the traditional standards of care anymore. They're like, no, I don't trust it. I don't trust you. I'm going to go to this functional medicine doctor. So it's like society's having this great awakening. And I imagine, and I definitely want to talk about this, that's showing up on college campuses in that generation.
It's really hard to show up authentically as yourself all the time. But I think it's important when you figure out like how to survive the systems. Like, I think there are ways and times and places that you shouldn't be like just saying everything you want to say. Sure. Yeah. But like, I think in some way, as I've like reflected on my life, like I've tried to stay in systems because I don't think systems will change if all of us leave them. And like maybe some way I exist to blow them up from the inside. But people don't like when outsiders tell them what to do. You know, like you could say, I'm going to be a wellness consultant and I'm going to go into hospitals and I'm going to tell them what to do. And they're going to go, you left medicine. Like you're not an academic. I don't trust you. I'll pay you money because my school says I should, but I don't really care what you have to say, right? Like we just don't, we have a big distrust of outsiders and you get a lot further staying with it as painful as it is. And I'd love to say like on the regular, I'm like, yay, I fixed that. But I hit so many things about systems that frustrate me like every day and contribute to burnout for me like every day. And it's just something that I know about me, which is like, I'm going to get mad at that. And like, that's going to like that's going to make me frustrated. And it's just.
Yeah. And here goes Jesse. Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure like that's what my therapist would say, too. She'd be like, oh, it's systems again, Jesse. Like, it's just systems. Like,
but here you
and
go.
It's like, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, you either say like when I was looking for jobs, I mean, my therapist was like, you know, you could go into private practice and you would have no systems and you would be flexible and you could do what you wanted to do. And I was like, yes. And I just don't know that that's where I'm destined to be of most use, like as this like external person who's living their life the way they want to live their life, but without fixing anything for anybody else. Like it just doesn't, I don't know, it just didn't feel right. And we agreed I would try one more time in an academic job before I did that. So we're on that
and
now.
Here we are. And it's lasted a while. Yeah. Lasting. And don't worry, we can edit this podcast if needed. If something Jesse has said is going to get her booted out of the system, I think we'll be good. I think we'll stay PG. But, you know, and it reminds me just of organizational culture as well. And when you're in these systems, there's a culture that exists, but really there's you know, and to your point, you can bring in a consultant, you can have the academic kind of the intellectual piece of evolving a culture, but you also need those that grassroots. You also need the people within the culture that are willing to do the work, the self-awareness, those transformational leaders that are, teaching these next generations of managers of how to kind of carry that torch. So, and I will say at Experience, that's one of the top things we're hearing from employers is that they're at that fork in the road of culture because COVID really shook it up. And then you have five generations in the workforce. Then you have the middle managers that are kind of piecemealed from those generations. And, you know, some are willing to grow and they're open to personal growth. Some are like, this is the way it's always been done. Suck it up, buttercup. We work a million hours if we need to. So you have this unbelievable kind of like kaleidoscope of things happening and workplace cultures today. So the Jessies, the Dr. Golds of the world. And you know what? I'll throw myself in that bucket. I've gotten myself into a lot of heat and systems. The Laura Coonses of the world, you know, but it's a tough process, don't you think, to learn how to use your voice? What was that like for you? And then were there any times that you can think of where you were like, okay, Jesse, you've gone too far. You've put yourself out there too much. You're so uncomfortable. Oh my gosh. Was that your book, the publishing of your book?
Good question. How did I learn? I mean, I grew up in a family where my dad speaks his mind. And I saw that as an example. My dad's an academic psychiatrist too. So I'll just say that.
Okay.
And so I think like we were never really like told that our opinions didn't matter or anything like that. So we're like supposed to read stuff and say stuff and talk about stuff. And so I always like did that at home and saw my dad do that in leadership roles. And so I had that as an example. But I think that it's harder as a woman. I also look very young. And so I think there are times where I feel like people are sort of like, they're their child. Like, just like, go with it. But, you know, which is, you know, something I've gotten used to. I mean, I'm slowly getting some wrinkles and stuff, but I look young and I'm short and I have curly hair.
It's also while you're not threatening, though, I'll say. Yeah. So that's a plus,
true.
Too.
Anyway, it works later. For students. Like, you know, I gave a talk the other day to like a bunch of sort of older women philanthropists, and they said, oh, I can see why students like you. But I was like, I was trying to understand if that meant they didn't, but they got why other people would. You know what I mean? I was like, maybe I'm appealing to like a certain generation, but not, you know, I was like, I get it. Like, it was like, you're so good for this role because students like you. And I was like, okay. But I think that there's truth in that too, which is like, that's just who I am. I'm always going to kind of be like that. But you know, like sometime, I mean, my book is more vulnerable than anything I've done, for sure.
Yeah.
It's not the first time I've talked about my own experiences that, like, you know, through writing and stuff. And so there are probably times where it was harder, like, just because it was like the first time, you know, but I think it's the most and it's the longest and it's more memoir than I thought it was going to be. And there's vulnerability in that. You know, I think people in psychiatry don't talk a lot about themselves because we were the career and the sort of like shape of the culture of psychiatry is built on like Freud and like this sort of like we don't talk about ourselves thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah, oh yeah, and so true. So many psychiatrists are very, they don't have bedside manner because they're so buttoned up.
Yeah. And like, I think that's evolved. If you look at like some of my friends are really different than that, but I think that, you know, what you see is sort of like, well, why are you sharing all of that about you? You're not supposed to do that. Like, you should stop doing that. And so like the messages you get even in psychiatry, where we do talk more about like our own treatment and stuff like that, at least internally, are sort of like, don't do that. Like, don't talk about that stuff. And so, you know, you get that as a message. And then you also get like this sort of like, is it narcissistic to tell your own story and to put yourself out there as an entity and not just like a sort of like a vessel by which you are a tool to help other people or, you know, whatever you want to say. And so I think that I do sometimes feel like people think I like do stuff to be famous or something. And I don't, if I could write as Mark Twain, I'd write as Mark Twain. Like, I don't have any desire to be like somebody that walks down the street and people know who I am, but it's just I'm a better communicator than some people. And that has led to social media and writing and stuff like that. And it's not like I have any desire to do it for me. Like, it's just the way that it is. And if I wrote with a pen name, it wouldn't make as much sense because I didn't go to training. Like, I would have to be this pen name that had the same training and the same everything. Yeah. And it's just totally stupid. And so, like, you know, I think there's this like weird thing that comes with medicine and psychiatry in particular, where people are like, if you're sharing about your story, like, you're doing it for you. And I don't know, I just have never like felt like that.
That I think exists in the behavioral healthcare field in general, because I'm not clinical, but I've had, you know, almost 17 years experience in the behavioral health profession. But we have so much knowledge of, you know, what a narcissist, you know, what those traits might be and what, you know, it's easy to overthink your behavior because, you know, we're aware of what those behaviors are. But I think it's always the intent and the motive, you know, behind something. And it's if it's the motive is to speak out about things that are vitally important to, honestly, society as a whole, like what you're doing, put yourself out there. But I totally relate to the overthinking of, okay, well, does it need to be me that's saying that? A million other people are saying something similar. And, you know, am I going to be looked at as that I'm just obsessed with self and I want people to see my face? I'm actually uncomfortable because my face is out there. It's that whole narrative, you know, but it takes so much courage to have that narrative and to still do it. And that the humility that's underneath that translates. You know, for example, you didn't seek this opportunity today. We sought you. And those are the types of people that I think really get their message across, where you can tell that they're just on this journey. And, you know, they're not putting themselves out there as a mental health celebrity. You just became one. You know, but I understand the whole narrative that goes on behind that.
Yeah. I mean, and you asked about like how I thought about authenticity. And I tell this story sometimes because I give the guy credit for it. But when I was in med school, I had a resident on one of my rotations who said to me, like, you're going to piss a lot of people off, but try not to change. And like when he said it, I was like, what do you mean I'm going to, like, you know what I mean? He got like defensive and I'm like, what do you mean I'm going to piss people off? Like, I'm here getting good grade. Like, what am I doing? I'm not doing anything. I'm just me. Like, how am I pissing people off? And he just meant like kind of the way I think about things and my humor and the way I like am kind of irreverent and all that kind of stuff. And he took me aside and said that, and I heard him and I didn't really think much of it. And then as I've like evolved and, you know, had my own experiences and thought about it. I mean, he's the only person who really said something like that to me, which was kind of like, the system's not ready for you, but don't leave it, you know?
Love.
And like, and he's a, I still know him. He's a great guy. I've told him that that was meaningful to me and he doesn't really remember saying it, but yeah. You know, like as are all things, when you say something super poignant to somebody.
You probably get that from patients in the past. Like, you said this and it changed my life. You're like, I really don't remember.
You're like, I'm so proud of myself. That was great. You know, but, and he knows cause I've said it before to him, but it's like, you know, I think even in the moment, I doubt he was like, I'm going to say something that's going to really help her. He just was kind of like, it's an observation. And I want to make it because I want to make it. And I felt like, you know, as I look back, I feel honored that he even felt comfortable saying something like that to me, because it's like kind of harsh. I mean, it's not harsh, but it's not easy feedback, you know, like especially as like a 23 or 24 year old or whatever, to be told like, people aren't gonna like you, but he's like, enjoy it, you know.
Girl,
but,
you wild.
But it made a lot of sense.
Get ready for a wild ride.
And it helps you to like, you know, think about how the things that might push people and push buttons, like when to use them and when not to. And I use humor a lot as like sort of a way in and out that's like a little less aggressive. Like, I tend not to be like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard anyone say, but more like, hey, that was a little racist, you know, like just to see what, you know, like, and see them, like, and it tends to work and land a little better with using like humor and stuff like that. And, you know, maybe not to everybody again, but I think that it has helped me to understand like ways to wield that in a way that's different. And, you know, as I think about managing to wield that in a way that's different too. And, you know, I think what you were saying about all the generations of managers, like, I mean, every time I give a talk, like without a doubt, someone in the audience will say, like, what did we do to the kids? Like, why are they so sensitive?
Oh, wow. Yes.
And like, why, like, what is wrong with them? Like, and it doesn't matter if I'm teaching like or like talking to healthcare or like PR professionals or like it pick a job. Someone will say it.
That's come up on this podcast, too. Yeah.
And if it's not that question, it's the other, which is like a defensive younger person who's like, obviously, wellness is important. Why is this so hard for people to understand? You know what I mean? Like, it depends on either way, right? But most often is the sort of like crankier other people. And, you know, my opinion is that there's like a couple things to think about. One is like, I don't think we're more sensitive. I just think we're more aware. And once you're aware, you can't turn it off. And like, when you know something should be done differently, like you see it everywhere. It doesn't mean it's going to change tomorrow, which I think is a problem that the younger generation hasn't fully understood how to deal with yet, because they would like things to change like tomorrow. And there are things that they're not wrong should change tomorrow, but it just doesn't work that way. And so there's a bit of like a, yeah, but systems. And so like, how do you figure out like how to survive in a broken system and say, yeah, that's totally broken. It'd be nice to fix it, but maybe it's not going to fix tomorrow. But there's an awareness component that makes it challenging, I think, because you can't turn that off.
Yeah.
And then I think that, you know, I don't know that we fully, and I'm going to probably get some flack for this, like fully understood how to navigate the concept of professionalism in the context of wellness. And I don't, people hate the word professionalism because it feels sort of like intersectionally complicated. And I totally get it, but it just take it for what it is at face value, meaning like professional expectations. I don't think, you know, especially in healthcare.
Mental health challenges make up 10% of workplace healthcare costs and lead to billions in lost productivity each year. Traditional employee assistance programs were created to help address these challenges. However, they are often underutilized because they are focused on reactive solutions instead of proactive solutions. That's why we created Spirence, to prioritize mental wellness in order to prevent mental illness. Spirence's science-backed platform offers an extensive and continually growing library of mental health courses crafted and delivered by clinical experts. The platform also features live events, interactive coaching, on-demand support tools, and dedicated support for managers. Our approach results in over 800% higher utilization than traditional EAPs. The world is moving towards proactive care, and Spirence is leading the way. Spirence, the future of workplace mental health.
Like, we have not figured out how to have a conversation around like what the field entails that cannot change, even if it's unwell. And I think that makes it really hard for people because they say, well, I'm entitled to having flexibility and a healthy workplace and time off and blah, blah, blah. And all of that is inherently true. But we have a system that lacks redundancy and doesn't have enough staff and is set up on the back of other people. And as that is the system, there's a bit of like, how do you navigate what it just means to do this job, even if it's unwell? And like, it doesn't, and I think people probably would be like a little surprised to hear that from me, given my job and stuff. But sometimes even like I'll have students think, I mean, like, because wellness is in my title, I don't really care when they do work ever. Like, I don't mean you can never do anything.
Right.
Like, that's not what wellness is. Like, I work really hard. It's just like, how do you navigate working hard and taking care of yourself? And like, most of us picked healthcare knowing full well it was going to be a lot of hard work and kind of miserable. And it just is. And I think that that's a big challenge in this sort of intergenerational conflict in healthcare workspaces, mental health workspaces, because the older folks are like, it's so much easier now, and they're still complaining, and they want like 6 days off a week to go like to appointments, and we can't do it. We just can't do it.
Yes.
And like, there's truth to that. And yet, like, you don't want to say like, you shouldn't be a doctor if you can't do that, but maybe you shouldn't, right? Like, it's a complicated conversation. And when people try to have it, they just get attacked. And like, someone wrote this piece for the New England Journal of Medicine, sort of looking at that concept, and just got ripped to shreds on social media. And like, there was, it was maybe the choice of words and how it was written and stuff too. But it's a very important conversation for the future of work. And I don't know the answer, but like, I'm not a person who's going to say like wellness means you don't work hard. Like, I work really hard, you know? So it just doesn't make any sense. Like, you have to figure out how to be well in the context of imperfect systems. You just
do. Oh my goodness. No, that is honestly music to my ears. We say that all the time here too, because wellness really should be woven through your life. And, you know, two things on that. One, our sister company, Experience, is a residential behavioral health care center here in Jupiter, Florida, where I am, you know, and we've owned and operated it for 13 years. And so that's where my background comes from. And we have a real crisis in residential behavioral health care right now, too, because of everything you just said, because burnout is real. And no one's saying that burnout is not real. There are physical, there are mental, there are spiritual implications to burnout. It's serious. And the train, this is how I put it, the train is moving faster than ever before today. We have technology, we have awareness, which floods healthcare systems because people are wanting to, I think, take care of themselves more now, not just their mental health, but their physical health. So you have like a flood of more patients, right? And not enough providers. And then you have the providers that have the passion for it that are fried because they went through COVID. And in behavioral health, it wasn't just COVID. It's that the conditions are more complex than ever because you also have the family system that went through COVID. So there's just, it's loaded. And so we talk about that a lot at Experience, you know, as we were building out the platform and just in general, when we're having conversations with employers, it's about teaching your people how to tolerate the pace of that train because you can't jump off. I mean, you can, but what does that look like? So how do we build resilience and increase each individual's capacity to handle? It's almost like this, I describe it for myself as an increasing pressure, right? It's like society is now this just like increasingly like pressure filled cooker. And there are ways to like pop the valve, but it's an individual journey to figure out what does that for you. And it's just, it's like, I don't know about you, Jesse, but you know, I'm preaching to the choir, but we're not preaching to the choir and we're preaching to workplaces, trying to help them understand that it's a layered approach within your culture to first make people feel safe, to be able to be authentic, as you put it, to build self-awareness and even understand that that's a key piece of this whole thing, to increase their communication skills, to be more effective in it, to your point, to be able to still speak out and be authentic, but to be respectful and fit within the system. You know, it's a multi-layered approach. And then you have these older generations, the boomers, and what's next to them. What's after boomers? X?
There is like an X.
I think they're like, someone said they're the forgotten generation. We just had an Xer on here. He's like, I'm the forgotten generation. But then, you know, and they're more of the mindset of what? I don't have time for that. You know, I'm not going to do that. And then you, I don't know which generation
are
you in.
I'm a millennial.
Okay.
Elder millennial.
I am too. Okay. And we're like almost like the bridge. You know, we're like, we could go either way. We still work hard.
It's like we had internet. We didn't have internet. Yeah. We had phones. We didn't have phones. Like, that's why we're all weird.
We're totally weird. And we're like kind of confused sometimes too.
Yeah. Yeah. They like gave us internet late and then we were like, oh, there's internet. And then they gave us phones and we're like, oh, we have phones. And like other people didn't have them in when they were younger. It's confusing. So
it is confusing. I feel like a lot of us are empaths too.
Yeah.
We woke up like big time.
Yeah. You know? Maybe 9/11. There's just like a lot of stuff in there too.
So with your role at the University of Tennessee and just talking about that younger generation. First, what's happening on college campuses today? As I mentioned, I'm a University of Tennessee alum, but kind of. So I went there for 1 year in 2001.
Knoxville?
And I went to Knoxville. Yep. And just a quick backstory. So I am a person in long-term recovery from an alcohol use disorder. And I quit drinking at 26. And the journey really started for me, the awareness journey to quit started for me at the University of Tennessee. And here was why. So, you know, kind of built up for me. I had a complex trauma at age 13 that led into alcohol use. that led into alcohol abuse, that led into this very confusing college journey where I went to one school, transferred to UT. I had five different majors throughout this college journey, transferred from UT onto University of Cincinnati. Anyway, when I was at the University of Tennessee, it was 9/11. So it was 2001. 9/11 happens. By that time, my disease had progressed to psychological dependence, physical dependence, not yet, but psychological dependence. And 9/11 happens, and it's like fuel on a fire, right? You have this mass societal trauma, and you have people having the world is ending parties, the alcohol use increases. And then you have the holy crap, like what's happening in the world. And it led to a severe depression for me to where I wasn't getting out of bed. I mean, I was sleeping until 2 o'clock in the afternoon up in my dorm. And I can't remember. It was either one of my parents or it was my boyfriend at the time said, you should see somebody. And so I looked into the counseling system there, easily got into a counselor. I went to see the counselor and he says to me, do you think you might be an alcoholic? You know, I was telling him what my day looked like, you know, sleeping till two. I was just telling how often you're going out, 7 days a week. How late are you staying out? 3 a.m. And he says to me, do you think you might be an alcoholic? And I looked at him and I said, I'm 19. That's nuts. No. And I left and I want to say two things about it. No, there wasn't any follow-up. No, there wasn't any, okay, well, this is what you should do. So in that way, it wasn't helpful because I had no next steps. I had no education around it in that moment. In another way, it was a life-changing event because it planted a seed. And over those next 5 years, it was one of the few things. Remember how you said you remembered what that guy said to you, right? Like there are those moments in life where people say something and it validates a truth within you that you're like, that meant something. Even if you don't want to know it at the time, you can't unknow it. And that was that. He was honest. So how would that look today if I were at the University of Tennessee?
I wish I could say like your stories are like so unique because I think that there's just so many people who the first time they get help is college and the way that it like hits is really important. And that's actually why I ended up wanting to do that population to begin with was like, you could be like the right landing for someone. And maybe they won't get treatment now, but maybe they'll go like, oh, that person asked me good questions and listened and cared. And like, I'm not scared to get help by a psychiatrist 4 years from now, whatever it looks like, right? Like when I was in college, I was depressed as a junior and like didn't want to get help and went and got help and talked to the counselor and was like super guarded and was like, yes, yes, no, no, blah, blah, blah. And then the person said I wasn't sick enough to get care on campus. And for me, I was like, I don't really know what that means. Like, I don't like, what does that mean? And I don't even know you. And I didn't even tell you everything because this is an intake. And I don't even like, I lied for half this. And like, okay, I guess I didn't really need to be here in the first place. And also it's invalidating at the same time because everyone else said I did and I'm confused. And luckily, like, my parents sort of made me go to the community and find someone else anyway. Like, it didn't really let me just go like, all right, like, I'm good. But,
why do I still feel like this?
Yeah, but
this is not helpful.
And I could have, right? Like, I could have just been like, well, they said I'm fine. And luckily, like, my friends and family didn't really let me do that and sort of, like, pushed it. But, you know, for me, like, again, sort of similar to you, like, that's why I was always, like, that wasn't okay. And I had never asked for help, even though my dad's a psychiatrist. Like, I'm a perfectionist overachiever who was fine. And my grades were fine. And so I was fine. And so I think, like, that has always been in the back of my mind of sort of, like, how we think about this stuff, because, you know, I think we spend a lot of time on intervention on college campuses. Like, you're a prevention person, so it probably doesn't surprise you that that's true. Like, I think in the context of crisis, you have to put out the fires. But not everyone needed to get to the fire. And so I think that we're like sort of scrambling to backtrack on some of this stuff for that folks.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And so like, you know, a benefit of my job versus, you know, being head of counseling on a campus is I don't have direct student involvement in that. Like, if you said like there is a event on campus and we have to deal with this, you know, person who attempted suicide, I could still go like, okay, well, like, what else are we doing? Because like, I have the ability to do that because I'm not on the campus directly responding to that. Like, I'm separate. So like having a bird's eye view in that sense allows like more thought around systems and prevention than, you know, really a person who works on a campus can do. Because if I'm head of counseling and we're having like 10 crisis, like all these people going to the hospital a day, like all I can think about is like, how do I put out that fire, help those friends, make sure that that faculty member knows about whatever, right? Like you're really focused on that and you don't get a second to go like, okay, but why? Like, are they all freshmen? Are they like, do they not have friends? Do they not feel connected? Do they not know where to go? Are we not teaching the right stuff? Do they not know signs and symptoms? Do they not know how to talk to each other? Do they, you know, like all this stuff that like you just don't have capacity to figure out because you're just trying to make sure people don't die, right? Like, and that's fair. Like, and we have a problem on campuses for sure. And we have for a long time. But college is a hard time and biologically is a hard time. It's like when schizophrenia and bipolar disorder come out in your brain. Also, you mentioned substances. I mean, it's like experimentation city and also it's identity development city. And so there's just a lot going on. There's and it always lot. Like it always has been. There's a lot going on. Like that's not new. But it, you know, if you look at trends and stuff, you can make arguments for different reasons why things are more complicated these days. But I think, you know, we have to look like holistically and from like a I'm a one out of one. What does that mean I have and what can I learn and what resources should I be turning to? I'm a three out of like 10. Where do I go now? I'm a four. And we just don't really we're not really looking at full spectrum of services and support and care because we're trying. But in the context, we're always going to have to be putting out the fire or if there's a state law that says something, answering the state law, like whatever it is, right? Like we're not able to go like, what are the trends and like, what are we missing and how do we teach this and what population is getting left out and what was wrong with that particular situation or, you know, like we just don't have the capacity to do that. And I think it's a unique thing that like I have the ability to do, but I think is also just as we think about how to help campuses, you know, I think you could have an infinity number of college counselors and you will always have a wait list. Like, you know, it's not like we can't counsel our way out of it. I think some of it, like, you know, things that people are dealing with, like they don't really have great emotion regulation. There's a lot of...
I was going to say it's skill too, because counseling doesn't always have time to teach the skills.
Especially not short term, like on a campus where you go like for five count, you know, like sort of like an EAP, you go like five times and that's what you get and you have to spread it out and all that stuff. And really like, you know, there's a probably over desire to label things in the younger generation because of TikTok and stuff like that's just like, I'm sad, I'm depressed. Well, are you just like sad? Because you could just be sad and that would be okay. And we don't need to give you drugs. And
I was going to say, because then that could lead to medication. We have providers saying that medication claims are through the roof right now, mental health related medications.
Yeah. I mean, I would say there's definitely still more stigma towards meds than therapy. Like, I think that is still true. Like, I don't think that it's as easy for people to talk about being on meds. I don't think it's as easy for people to ask for meds. But I do think that there's also like meds can sometimes feel like a Band-Aid, like a better Band-Aid, even though our meds are freaking imperfect. Like, I mean, they're so imperfect, but there's like a desire. And I see healthcare workers who, you know, would like to go back to work tomorrow. And if they could go back to work tomorrow with me giving them a pill, they'd be totally happy to take the pill. Like, yeah. They don't want to talk about their feelings and spend 6 months figuring it out and to feel worse before they feel better. That's terrible, totally. You know? And so, like, there's this desire for meds to do things that meds can't do. Like, if you look at the evidence, if you look at how not, I mean, our meds are fine, but they're not, like, the answer to all things. And if it's, like, you know, trauma or something, all you're doing is sort of, like, band-aiding the symptoms and not, like, the cause. And yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about that. But, you know, I think we see, like, they definitely don't have good emotion regulation, like, skills. I think we really struggle with friendship and socializing and connection on campus. I think, you know, The reason Vivek Murthy and people like that wrote, like, about loneliness is, like, it's real, it's important, it's something to be talking about. But, you know, I hear a lot from, like, faculty and staff on campus that, you know, they don't really have, like, people skill, like, the people don't have ability to even know how to make friends. But it's like, if I had an event and I called it, like, let's make friends, like, no one's coming to that. That sounds terrible.
Yeah.
So, like, how do you teach people that stuff? And I think you have to do it in some way that's, like, secret or something. Like,
I know.
It's not easy. And so I think, you know, social media contributes to that, but it's not the entire problem. It's too simple to say it's the entire problem. COVID contributed to that too, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think those kind of things are also skills. Like, how do you talk to people? How do you make friends? What does conversation look like? I mean, I think there's been a lot of books recently about, like, social health and social psych and, like, conversation. And I think that's because, like, all of us think that we know how to do it and none of us actually do. And so, like, they're trying to teach people in books, but I don't know that anyone, I don't know how popular all those books are, but I definitely see that there's, like, a trend towards, like, those books. So I don't know if that's, like, the new self-help is people want to know how to do that, but I don't know.
Well, I mean, I love that you brought that up because I've been thinking about that a lot lately with what it used to look like in terms of community. You know, I mean, even like a family system, it used to be these, you know, you had a village. You know, you had a village. It was, you didn't go far from your family. And now, and I think it's great that society has evolved. And, you know, now, especially the younger generations, you see some of them, their jobs are to travel all over the world and, like, eat, you know?
Yeah.
And I think
post social content about
yes, it. Yes. I just saw some chart that said it was like 60% of that generation that's their career goal, which is what they want to do. Which is awesome. But to your point, then what do we do about the social piece? And I know, is it awesome? I'd do it. Let's go. I'll travel to Italy and eat the best sandwiches in Florence. Like, let's go. I mean, I don't know. Have you even noticed for you? I socialize way less than I did before the pandemic. I'm working from home. You know what I mean? So many of us are working from home. So you don't have that community, and that's a dying, you know. And then we have technology, which is advancing even more, which actually could eventually help some of those things. But it's just interesting to think about, like, long term, it's either going to go one extreme or it's going to go the other. I guess so. In your mind, what is the most important next step for advancing this continuum on college campuses?
Buy-in.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's always buy-in, right? Like, there are always, like, we have this a lot with, like, curricula development, right? It's like, I think we should learn about nutrition. Okay, well, if you want to teach a nutrition class, you have to get rid of 75 things on infectious disease, right? Like, it's always like a push-pull situation. And I feel like very similarly about what people choose to invest and care about, right? Which is like, you can give lip service to a lot of this stuff, right? Like, you can say, oh, I care about wellness. I care about employee wellness. Like, it's important for recruitment and retention. Yay. And you have someone like me wandering around, like, smiling and waving and doing nothing. And it looks like you care. And congratulations, you look like you care.
Yes, yes.
And that's a step. Yeah. But it's not a step I want to be part of. You know, like I would never have taken a job that I would have been a figurehead or that I was not going to be able to evolve what support and what it looked like. Like it just wouldn't have made sense. I'm too young for that. I don't want to sit in a job and just like do nothing and smile. It's totally, speaking of authenticity, like completely counter to my values to just sit there and pretend to do something and not actually support people. So, you know, I think buy-in is not just like titles and names, and it's not just like a program. It's like really sustainable change. Yeah. And that takes time and energy. And most of the time is really not sexy, right? Like every time I talk to someone on a campus, they're like, pilot this, do that, la la. Yeah. And I get it. Like, and I'm on, you know, I'm on LinkedIn. People try to sell me stuff all the time. But yeah, the thing is, like, products aren't the answer most of the time. Yeah. Like, I don't even know like all of our data yet. Like, I don't even know all of our baseline like numbers. Like, that's not sexy. Numbers are not sexy. It's totally boring. I don't even know what we're doing for programming on every campus yet either, right? Like, we have to understand like what we're doing, what works, what doesn't work, how we're investing, why, all of this stuff in a way that's like thoughtful and sustainable. That's not like, let's buy a shiny thing and say we bought this shiny thing. Like, if the answer is an app, cool. But like, let me figure that out first, or like, let people figure it out first. Right. And I think that like a lot of times people get put in roles like mine and are also expected to change stuff like tomorrow. Like, that's not a fair assessment. Like, when I was starting, I said, 1 month to, or like 1 year to a year and a half of just figuring out what the heck they do before I even tell you any goals. And they were like, okay. But, you know, like that took some like trust that like maybe somebody wouldn't have given because they're paying me. Right. And like, it's easier to go like, look, Jessie's doing something, like she bought an app, like go Jessie. And like, but that's not actually like, it's not actually doing something. It's just putting a shiny thing in front of your face and saying, I care. And so I think that it's like sustainable change, less sexy change. And it's like understanding that culture is part of it. Like, I'm a big culture person. I majored in anthro. I have a master's in anthro. I'm the person who in this sort of burnout conversation is not just talking about electronic medical records and like things that are the problem. Yeah, of course, they're the problem.
Yeah.
But like, of course, insurance like and paperwork and like prior auth and all that stuff in healthcare is contributing to burnout. But so is like, you know, working in places that don't care that you're there.
And 100%.
Like, if we don't actually address that part, it's not making workplaces better for people. Because as I've told my therapist, like, I can work really hard as long as I'm valued. And I can expect to work hard and be okay working long hours. And I can be okay, like, not doing things I want to do all the time. But like, you have to know that people care about what you do and that what you do matters and that like you're in a place that like values your existence. Otherwise, you're like a pawn. And that's why most people hate their jobs in healthcare.
It's so true. And I think that middle manager layer is so essential to that, too. If you're in a leadership role, if you're in a management role, just at this point, it's like you really have to expand that skill set.
Train managers to care. Like, here's the thing. Like, most people get put in management because they're good at the wrong stuff. Like, most people in healthcare are leaders because they have good papers. Like, they could like do studies on rats. Like, that doesn't mean anything. So you have to teach them to be leaders. It's not fair to put them in a leadership role where they're in charge of people when they have no people skills and all of their expertise is rats. Like, you have to teach them. And it's not fair of our sort of like workplaces to like let people stumble into leadership based on success as an individual and assume that like they're going to be able to create cultures. Like, it's just not a thing. Like, I didn't go to business school.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, amen to that. I bet so many people listening can relate to that, either in themselves as a manager or in their workplace, watching that happen. Because it's amazing the impact that managers have on a person. There's a lot of data around that, and it's both sides. The negative impact they have the potential to have and the positive impact they have the potential to have. And I mean, it's worth the resource investment of time and financial, whatever it takes for an employer to invest at that. They really don't have a choice at this point. And Jesse, we're talking about that every day with employers because they're seeing that. They're kind of throwing up their hands and they're saying the traditional things don't work. And it's interesting what you said about college students and it being super complicated. Because, and what you said about data in general, and not, there's so much that would have to be analyzed. I wonder, this is just a side thought, I wonder if technology will eventually help us with that, help us to have the bandwidth to be able to do that. I hope all of you enjoyed talking to Jesse / Dr. Gold. Because both showed up here, which I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for.
I hope they're the same person.
Yeah. Okay. Everything we just talked about, I just threw out the window. You've integrated beautifully, Jesse.
Thank you.
You've integrated. For real, though. I mean, it's not, you know, most psychiatrists, it would not be easy to have a 1 hour conversation with, like we just did. We went over our time, whatever. You're like, I'm not in charge, you are. I just want to thank you, though, for being willing to do this. I know that your time is valuable. And thank you to everybody who tuned in today. Hopefully you learned something. Join us again for the next episode of Prevention Pioneers, and we'll talk to you then. Thanks.